Welcome to Watching Silent Films. This is Yifeng. With me are my co-hosts Adam and Lily. Hello.
Hello there.
Hey.
Greetings, greetings. Just wanted to, say that our podcast is one where we pick a film or a series of shorts, watch it and talk about it. That's what we do here. And make a real quick announcement. This will be, I think, number 50, episode 50. So by the time it gets to 52, 52 will be our final episode. We're going to sail into the sunset, but more on to, I think a little later, in later episodes, we'll dig into it more. But this time we're going to talk about Sunrise by F.W. Murnau, A Song of Two Humans. I think it's the subtitle. It's directed by F.W. Murnau. Before we get going there, let's do a little bit of what we've been watching in the classic realm. You guys watch anything interesting since we last recorded?
I began watching a little bit of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes on YouTube. A little bit was cut. I have not finished it, though. I am so bad at that. But I want to keep watching the movie, so I'll have it finished by next week.
Maybe you'll watch the last 5 minutes first and kind of...
No, I started from the beginning.
Doing piecemeal, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it was a suggestion right after Sunrise, so I was like, okay, never seen it before, so why not?
Trust Google's algorithm, right?
Possibly, hopefully.
Were you on to me?
Sure.
Okay, I didn't want to interrupt. I tackled on something a little bit big. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called Judex from 1917. It's French. It was a serial. It has a prologue and 12 chapters. I saw it on YouTube first, but then there was no music there, so I went to Canopy and I got it there and had the music, and it was a better print. It was kind of interesting, historically anyway. It might be one of the first pulp heroes, at least on film.
It's a predecessor of The Shadow.
There you go. Do you know the story at all?
Why don't you tell it since you've seen it?
Sure. Well, anyway, it's a masked vigilante. He goes by the name Judex, which is Latin for judge. He fights against criminals led by the corrupt banker Favarum. Basically, what it starts off with is they introduce a ton of characters in the prologue. I mean, there was more than you can even take in. But with 12 episodes following that, they managed to give everybody something. What it was is this banker, 20 years previously, got money. I forgot how he got the money, but he used it. And basically, he was cutthroat all the way through. He would ruin lives, drive people to suicide. And one of those was Judex's father. And that's what basically started him doing this. He wanted to do something with the family. I don't remember what the scandal would have been, but... the father couldn't take it. He commits suicide. There was two brothers. They go away somewhere. So they're basically working together, and it's not really a masked situation at all. He just wears, I don't know, an outfit almost like Zorro without the mask. It's just all in black, and he's got a cape. I think they all have to have a cape. And it just kind of went on its way. I mean, the director, Louis... what's his name? Louis Fayed. Before that, he did Le Vampires, yep. Which was another serial, and he used the same woman as the bad guy here. And then before that, he did Fantomas. So this was his third way out. The previous two people were complaining that it glamorized crime, and so this was his way of turning that around and giving you a hero. So what he did was he sent letters threatening the banker, saying, if you don't give your money to charity, you'll come to harm. And so I think it was it was either an engagement party or birthday party or both. The banker appeared to have died. And so everyone, as far as everyone was concerned, the banker died. But in reality, Judex kidnapped him with his brother and held him prisoner. And meanwhile, the daughter honored the letter and gave her wealth to charity and basically lived poorly. The thing I thought was interesting, this was 1916 and French, so I didn't know, what the custom was, what the culture was. She had a son that she took with her, And eventually he meets up with this kid who's an orphan and homeless, and he's kind of like the Artful Dodger. That's the kind of character he was playing, lifting it from Oliver Twist. And I thought it was weird. I didn't really understand what I was seeing. It's her son just kept kissing him all the time on the cheek, and I said, "Well, that seems more than I've heard about Europe. It just didn't seem. I just didn't understand it." So I looked it up, and they had a female, 5-year-old or so, playing a male, and she had a crush on the guy that was playing opposite her, the kid. So I just thought that was interesting. It went on. They just, like I said, they introduced a lot of different characters. They went through a lot of drama. He kept the banker in the cell, and it was like they were trying to show what they considered high tech. They had a mirror opposite the peephole, and wherever the prisoner went, they could move the mirror around to follow his every move. And so when the prisoner tried to do something to the mirror, he got electrified. So this went on for 12 episodes. They would try different things, had different storylines, and then it all tied up at the end. Basically, everyone, one bad guy found his father was out of jail after being put there because of the banker. The mother had passed. There was just all these different plot lines that were kind of like zooming in and out of each other, and then it all finally came together.
Yeah, kind of like the early soap opera days.
Well, a combination of that and like Flash Gordon type thing or Shadow type thing.
Right, which is later, right? These are all predecessors of that, right?
Right, but it's instead of being too soap opera-ish, it was more like a superhero type thing. Although he didn't really do too much of anything. He would show up, but mostly they had such a huge cast, they really couldn't even use him that much. But it was interesting, and they did have a 1962 version, which I actually did watch too, just to see him. The storyline's tied up, and he did pay a good homage to it. I guess the director of that, I don't remember his name, was might have been related to the original. So that's it for me.
Yeah, film serials are kind of basically staples of filmmaking since really the beginning. I mean, there's really early serials. The American serials from the silent era was the Pearls of Pauline.
Oh yeah, I can't see a good copy of that. Is there a good copy of that?
I don't know where to locate that, but that's a
Yeah, it's on
popular
YouTube,
one.
but it's not it's hard to watch.
Yeah, and The Exploits of Elaine by Path
Oh,
Ferreras is
I
also
don't know that
another.
one.
If you just Google the Wikipedia for what's it called, serial film, or it gives you a list somewhere, and it basically tells you kind of the story of the serials were popular because it's one of those things that it's typically, how it's shown, right, in the releases in the cinema. Is that usually you'd have a variety show, and the variety show would include these serial episodes, episode one, and maybe a comedy right before the feature film at the end of the night, right? And that's buffered by live action, like in real life vaudeville performers and whatnot, or variety shows. So,
Well, it was really early in the game, so that
right.
was
And
something.
so these are incredibly popular because what the concept behind this is that you would have somebody going on the first night, and you see episode one, and it's like, well, how do you get them on the hook to return for next week, and so on? So, of course, you develop episode two, and on and on and on. So,
Cliffhanger.
yeah, that's the whole kind of notion, right? That it developed even especially during the early part, and of course, it became incredibly popular in the 20s, 30s, and beyond. But of course, until TV came along, right? Because ultimately, they're basically doing TV soap opera way before the original TV soap opera came along. And when TV and soap operas came along, it essentially displaced the serial in the traditional film medium, right? Usually the shorts would be shown in front of the feature films. That was kind of the interesting things. The closest thing that nowadays, which it's a callback or paying homage to the old ways, is the if you ever watch any Disney slash Pixar movies. At least the last ones that I saw in the theater, they still were doing that, but sometimes they show a short, right? Like, what was the last one? I didn't go see Onward, but before that, there was Toy Story 4. They would show like a short, or some Frozen stuff. They would show like a short,
right?
Of some sort of demonstration that they're testing. You know, usually it's a technology demo, but it's also a very short story behind it. You know, and of course, like Pixar and stuff, they collected all these shorts too and packaged them. But if, which, of course, you know, all of them would be incredibly aware of film history, and all of that is paying homage
Right.
to the early days.
Well, what surprised me is these seem to be three-reelers, which was kind of long for a serial, I thought.
Right.
So yeah, that was my viewing.
Yep. Yeah, that's great, 'cause that we hadn't really. The closest thing we talked about was one of the maybe not episode, but like a trailer for Phantomas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Same
remember that.
director. We just didn't get into the 300-minute material.
Right. Actually, I'll
The
probably
more you
tackle
peel
that
back,
next.
the more you're like, there's just so much to watch.
Oh,
Even the
God, yeah.
silent era, even with 90% loss, that 10%, it's still tremendous, the volume
Yep.
of work that you don't even know if in an entire lifetime you could actually tackle all of them. You know what I mean? So
Right.
that's great about the silent era. It's just a virtually inexhaustible supply of films to watch.
Yeah, I'm finding that out. That was a
Yeah,
project. It was like watching Netflix and binging.
essentially, yeah.
'Cause that's what we've been doing. Although it's coming, I think it's coming back to episodic here and there, but for the most part we've been doing it serial wise. You know, a season would be basically what I just saw, a season of Judex.
Which is, you know, funny because everybody's always, I guess, being surprised that, oh, this is the first time it's been happening on TV, and well, the TV that you know, but it's been happening since the dawn of films, right?
Oh yeah.
Serialized storytelling in episodic format, it's been happening since the 1900s, you know?
Right.
So the more people get shocked by all these things that are happening, the more you're like, well, if you know anything about film history, it's really, you know, all par of the course. It's
Well,
not
it's
just.
funny, people have been pushing Schitt's Creek on me for so long that I finally looked at it. And I'm saying this is basically what the whole 60s was, fish out of water from A to B. It's almost like Green Acres. It was very close to Green Acres, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if the creator of that content knows about that. Maybe they're either
Oh, he would. Of Schitt's
knowingly
Creek,
or
yeah. He,
unknowingly.
that I don't know, but he's pushing 70, so he would have known about Green Acres.
Right.
Because it's a father and son team who put that together. And
Right.
the father's been around forever. He was in the American Pie series. The father with the eyebrows. He's most you can the first thing you see about him is his eyebrows.
Oh,
That's
Eugene Levy.
that's
Yeah,
it.
Eugene Levy, yeah.
Yeah, and his son, I think his name might be Daniel. It's basically they're the ones who created it. But yeah, to me, I mean, people who are telling me about this never saw what I saw in this, you know, from 60s TV, and I'm like, it's the same thing.
Yeah, just coming
Well, there's
back,
nothing
you know.
new. Yeah.
Oh, of course. All right, well, I myself didn't get around to catching anything. I think I've seen bits and pieces of things, but I didn't really. Nothing I would say chalk up to classics or anything like that. So, but let's move on. So, let's see here. Let's get into F.W. Murnau's Sunrise. This was a film that was released in 1927, I think.
Yep.
Yeah,
Correct.
28 or 27.
27.
And, many people have proclaimed this one of the greatest, if not the greatest, silent films film, just film of all time.
I can see
And
that.
yeah, and it's the first, it appeared in the first Academy Awards and was awarded the best, not best picture, but a totally created category called Unique and Artistic Picture
Yep.
at the first Academy Awards and never appeared again. So it's a category was created for this picture, and that was it.
Oh, wow.
They haven't created this category in all subsequent award shows. It's just the first one, and they're like, this is so unique. We're creating a separate category just for this movie and
Right.
giving it the award.
They could have
an actress.
totally used that throughout all of this time. Oh my God.
Well, anyway, the actress, Jenna Gaynor, won the award. She's the, I think she's the wife, right?
Yep.
So she won
She's
the
the
award for
wife,
this
yeah.
one.
She was in A Star Is Born, the first one.
The original, yeah.
Yeah.
Original. Yeah, so won a lot of acclaim and from the time it was released and also just throughout the years, it just continues to be ranked really high. And in the 80s, it got inducted into the Library of Congress, pretty certain. And so yeah, and the plot is essentially we got this farmer guy who's raising a family with wife and kids. The farmer's played by George Brian. The wife's played by, as we just talked about, Janet Gaynor. And they have a kid who's, they're raising. And this woman from the city comes along, stays behind, and is basically tempting this man to leave the family behind to join, to go to the city. And essentially, she proposes that he kill his wife and sell the farm and just do away with the life. And he tries to do that but doesn't, and then ultimately the wife feels rejected by him, and they go on an adventure to kind of rekindle their marriage when at the end, on their way back from the city back to the rural area, they a storm overturns the boat, and she seems like went overboard and was dead, but it turns out not to be. That's kind of the end. We're just gonna spoil everything, so it's fine. So then the woman from the city comes back, and he rejects her one more time. The woman's found again, and they kind of happy ending essentially. So that's the plot.
Yeah.
As frequent listeners of this podcast knows, I am a big fan of F.J. Murnau, the director. I find all of his films, including the ones that aren't like Sunrise, which is really popular, but I find all of them really rich and full of incredible techniques of film direction, and just somebody who actually thinks about shots and sort of figure things out. So, it's not a surprise that when he, this is his first American film, he would have been recruited by William Fox, which is the guy behind Fox Studio. That, finally is got folded nowadays into Disney. But for a long time, that Fox, that name, was produced by, William Fox. That's the guy, the namesake that runs that studio.
Is that the same as 20th Century Fox?
Yeah, it's all the same sort of
Same Fox.
umbrella, same
Okay.
guy. Yeah, so William Fox is the original, because in the beginning, all these studios, right? You got like the Paramounts, the MGM, the Warner
Right.
Brothers, and you got all these people overseeing all these various studios, and you would know them if you kind of study a little bit of film history, by like Louis B. Mayer would be one of the MGM guys. He's one of the M's of MGM, right?
Right.
Or Warner Brothers, both of the Warners, and obviously, well, Disney is the namesake still there.
Yep.
Fox is one of them. What else is there? Anyway, there's a whole bunch. They're all just, they're the movers and shakers, right? The original guys who created these studios or run the studios. But
Branding is everything.
it is, but it's interesting because this guy, it wasn't very successful. Fox, throughout all of the first run in the first 10, 15 years, maybe up to 20 years of it, of their existence, his films, he's his sort of modus operandi was to recruit the best artist and create the best story, because he is so adamant and maybe prideful, maybe, or arrogant. I don't know what the word you want to use, but there's a good biography on him. I can't remember, but if you just Google his biography, there's either one or two, maybe just one, because nobody has written about him. And somebody who knows one of his very distant grandchildren or something ended up contacting them and writing a whole biography on him himself, William Fox, and basically it wasn't as successful as any of the other studios because his basically he wants to make the best movies, and his thought is that if you make the best movies, the audiences will come and pay him with a load of cash, which is not true, as we know,
Yeah.
with now 100 plus years of history. So
Oh, yeah.
his films have largely been kind of failing, including this one. It wasn't a huge box office success when it first came out, and people's response kind of muted. It only gathered in steam, I think, in time, right? As with a lot of classics. So just a little note before we get in there. So let's start with Lily. What'd you think of Sunrise?
I think it's interesting that they say it's one of the greatest films of all time, because at first I didn't really see it, but I can see how it has definitely influenced movies in our generation. Because, like, at the very end, I completely saw Titanic with the water. It was just, I mean, the movie makes me very emotional. But it was just very interesting with the parallels, of like searching for the wife over the water with the lantern, and like, seeing the reeds just disperse, and like I'm thinking of the bodies that happen like in the movie. And I actually tried to see if like there was a reference of James Cameron ever, I'm sure he has seen Murnau films, but if there was that one specific link. So that part of the film I thought was like, just the way it tied into now is excellent. Thought it was very interesting how it, Murnau still kind of delves a bit into the psyche. And what I wrote is just, there's like the split personality of the husband. He's going from, and the insane, I called it like insane murderer of like trying to either kill off his wife or kill off his lady, or, being, the love of his wife's life. It was just very interesting, and I don't know, I kind of wish those were played with a bit more, because you see him like go through the struggle and attempt the murder, and then he gets kind of normal, and then he repents, and then he kind of gets back to being a genuine man again, and then he loses his wife, so he goes through that psychosis kind of in a repeat, and then he tries to go kill the woman. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to figure out how, like, that was supposed to be laid out. But it could just be acting. It could all just be up in the actor's mind too. And part of this film was interesting too, because I assumed it was going to be another horror from Murnau, even though it's been some time since Nosferatu was created. So, it's a romantic narrative, but it does slip back into the genre of fear when that thing, those, excuse me, when that's happening, like losing his wife, or, the horror of murdering somebody. You could tell too, he was just kind of like at the very, very beginning when all these things were like in motion and all this, the city was coming out to life. I was kind of just a little confused about where we were supposed to be going, but once it kind of smoothed over, it seemed more straightforward, of course. But I definitely liked how Murnau laid out the intertitles and just kind of the overlays between, while the husband's thinking about killing his wife, the woman comes in and kind of like pressures him to, off her. And I'm trying to like double, I don't know, Yifeng, is that double exposure when the woman's face kind of comes over his body and like whispers in his ear? Sometimes I get them confused.
It can be. In this particular one, the way he would create the effect would be to oh, what's another movie? We've seen many of these before. Buster Keaton's done many of these techniques. So what happens, you take the same exact film that you film for a scene, you know, let's say you film the left side of the frame.
Right.
You then you take the same film, thread it through, and then record the right side of the frame.
Right, yeah.
So I don't even know what the term for that is, but you would just continue to build the material using the same exact film until you get the final product. Because this film was made before what's called optical printers. Optical printers is like you basically take two pieces of film and join them into a final product. So that makes this process easier. So you could do stuff like fading and all that jazz, like without playing and tampering with the actual original negative. But, you know, George Melies, of course, you know, from the 1890s to 1900s has been doing this, you know, in his back experimental lab since forever. So, you know, it's the technologies and the technique has been there. It's just how to do it, you know, and how it gets done more efficiently in time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I have to say that I was running about that same exact scene because I know if you mask off one, you can composite together, but have her share the same space as he is, but be over him. I'm just wondering if they had the male actor stay there through both takes. That way, only she is, you can only see through her, but nothing else. You know, hugging him?
Yeah, I think
seemed like it was hard to do that.
I think
that.
You'd have to, he's basically there, in this particular film, they're basically taking the same negative and running over and over again until they get what they needed it. Which is risky because if you screw up and it gets chewed up, right? You lose however long days of work in the first take.
So, worth the risk, though. That's what many filmmakers do. They have to take those risks, otherwise.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's all for nothing. And I just want to say, when we were talking about Buster Keaton, I'm looking it up. We did that in the Playhouse where he overlaid himself.
Oh, yeah.
Just as a reminder to the listeners.
So the biography I was referring to, I found, is written by Vanda Kreft. Or, I don't know, Kreft. But it's the man who made the movies, The Meteoric Rise and Tragic Fall of William Fox. So we'll probably link to that in our show notes. It's really fascinating. I've never read it, but I've seen her interviewing with other podcast people, and it's pretty good. It's pretty good from what I hear. Anyways. Anything else, Lily?
I'm trying to think. One thing, I was very surprised at how young Janet Gaynor is in this movie. I believe I did the math, so she might be 20 or 21, where her husband is possibly like 30 something. I didn't check his age math, but I was like, oh man, it was just very surprising to me because I was like, oh my god, she's so young. Because I remembered her name from A Star Is Born, even though once again have not seen it, but I was trying to be like, who is she, you know.
That was in color.
I know. Wow. Yeah. And it was 10 years later after this one. I believe that one came out in 37.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So, what was I going to say? Yeah, just kind of like almost a Mary Tyler Moore, Dick Van Dyke version of like the age gap. So I thought that was unique as well. Well, I don't know. Unique's not the right word, but just an interesting choice, definitely.
I think that happens a lot in movies. The woman is, like, a lot younger.
Yeah. I mean, possibly it's, like, another reason for why he would want to be with the woman, the city girl woman, whatever. Because it's like, oh, you know, she's an adult and she's, you know, a real woman, where he's got, like, this chick, you know, this young girl who's barely had her feet wet in life. So it's like, yeah, why not come over to the city with me? Get rid of your child.
Yeah, so the wife, Janet Gaynor was born in 1906, so by 1926 she would have been 20-ish, I would say. George O'Brien, the farmer main character guy, is born in 1899, or roughly, so he would have been roughly 27-ish.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's not that much of a difference, but he looked a lot old. It's so funny with age.
It's the makeup, right?
Yeah, it's the makeup.
And the city girl was born in 1895, so even older.
Well, I think George is a bodybuilder, and sometimes that makes you look older.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have much else that really impressed upon me. Some things, it was just kind of like, I almost saw bits of slice of life with their relationship and trying to culminate what they had lost within like the 10 minutes of him trying to decide if he wants to offer or not on the boat. And she's just like, oh no, I can't save myself. You know, But I don't know, maybe one of you will bring something up and it'll jog my memory. It's a Sunrise. I mean, I liked it. I don't know what else I can really say about it, though. It's definitely a form of expression of the human soul. Song of Two Humans.
Adam?
Well,
Adam, what
I
do you
liked
think?
that they were two incredibly wealthy
All right, how
couple.
about one of you
They
guys?
had lakefront property. They had a servant, a nanny. How good can it get? I know just from listening to the commentaries when I watched it that they wanted to make it look European, so you didn't have the feeling that you were in America, you were someplace in Europe. There was the article that iFun gave us called "The Turn and Return of Sunrise" by Dudley Andrew. It was written in 1984, and the one that thing that struck me is the first titling is "The Human Condition Between." Oh, the condition between two humans, the story between two humans. Yet there's three people sharing the same level of credits. Margaret Livingston, the vamp, being the third
Like
person.
a force of
So he
nature.
thinks that she was kind of thought of as inhuman, causing a rift between the two humans, almost like a natural disaster, something, luring him into something that he couldn't say no to. Almost like a storm coming, and Murnau's known for highlighting storms. She was kind of that storm in their relationship, and basically how he overcame it, and how he could easily slip right back into it. And she was the innocent. Yes. And then they exemplify that toward the end, where they're coming back after an idyllic, when they got back together and they were in love all over again, the storm happened. So it was almost being. It's almost saying, it's not over yet. You think you've conquered this, but no, here comes the storm. We're going to throw some more in your direction. And the vamp, the woman from the city, just seems to be part of that storm, part of that evil, part of that situation that they have to overcome. So it's the story between the two humans, but she's the element who's basically, the villain in this piece. I noticed when the fonts started happening in the titling, I got a Frankenstein vibe from it. It felt like the same type of fonting that the Frankenstein would use. And then it seemed to, even later on, just seeing him, the way he was dressed kind of like Frankenstein. And when he was coming back from the vamp's apartment, they put lead weights in his boots, so he was walking like Frankenstein. When he was in the boat, almost going through with killing his wife, he was very Frankensteinish. I just thought that was interesting. The thing that struck me almost right off, and I think it did everyone, and I think what really put it in my head was the commentator, was the wig that they had her wear. It just made Janet not look like Janet. It was just very, very unappealing. So you could almost, it was almost showing you how he went to the vamp because she was more stylish, where, the wife was just very down to earth, practical, not romantic and not exciting. I'm a big fan of models, and right off the bat, they had the model train. Well, first they start with the drawing, which melts into the model. There was so much composited in just that very, in that beginning scene, where they had the model train, the real people, the matte paintings of the buildings behind that, and another model train coming through the other side. I noticed I've been doing some research, although I'm not an expert on it, as far as how sound started about this period, and I've noticed that the aspect ratio is a little tighter because that's when they used to put the soundtrack on, I think, the left-hand side of the film as you're looking at it, and that way they can include the music and the sound effects and the crowds and so on and so forth. So it was almost making the jump into sound, but didn't quite do it. One thing I noticed, I looked at some posters of, advertising the film. And when you see the poster and you look at the husband, he looks like someone that from today. Not so much when you see the movie itself, but when you see the posters, you almost do a double take because I said, was this just taken? Did they put someone else there? But then when you see, the movie itself, you can see it's of its time, but the poster, it looked more, not so much her, but he looked more, recent. The swamp scenes were talked about. It was a tight set, but they made it work so it looked bigger than it was. And he did something that I don't know if anyone else ever did. Well, the commentator was talking about the second person, Struess, Karl Struess. He was second in billing, but he actually did most of the work because Charles Rocher, he was sick, and so he had to hand it off. And he might have been the one, but I'm not sure if I remember that right. That he, first of all, he put the motor on the crank, so it was turning the film by motor instead of hand cranking it. And then the swamp scene was completely in studio, so he had the camera mounted on top by the ceiling, and then just guiding it so it followed him almost in a figure eight to make it look bigger than it was. Let's see. Although the amusement park, even today, you don't really see that many visuals all at once like that. It's almost like a music video where there's just so much coming at you. Only it's not digital. It's whatever effects they use. Some of it matte paintings, some of it modeling, some of it people in the background, some of it composites. And it was just so much. If you'd freeze frame it and just look around, there was a lot to look at. The photographer, I just got a kick out of it. I don't know if I've got him right, but he was in the TV Superman when it was a pilot. It was an episode called Superman versus the Mole Men, and so he played the I think he played the security guard, Pop Shannon. So you get to see him a little later on. I like to follow people around to just see where they pop up or if you can even hear what their voice sounds like. I've actually been on a Conrad Veidt kick lately, looking at his sound films. When they were in the photographer's studio, it was just funny where they were acting like kids again, as if they were like 15. But I know the music went with the it was what was on the film, so it was shot then. But I questioned it when all of a sudden I heard bits and pieces of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour theme song that you always hear before the TV show started. But I looked it up, and it is an older piece from 1872, called "The Funeral March of a Marionette." But I just, it, like I said, it threw me off. I just thought someone was messing with the sound, or maybe something new was put there. But no, that was a piece that existed. Not sure why, but there was a lot of money being spent when they were going through the city. They were making a lot of focus on the fact that they opened up their tiny little purse and kept spending the money that they must have been saving forever, just to pay for this, that, and the other thing. There was a lot said about the train they took going through the country and then the city, and that might have been a chassis put on top of a car, and that was made up especially to basically taking you from one situation to another. It was nice the way they used the horn when the wife was thought to be drowned and he was ca calling for her. And they were using the h horn to basically make the sound as if they were calling for the wife. The boats that were looking for the wife, it was just a great shot. It was darkness, but you see the boats and then the
Oh,
lights
good.
coming from the
You caught all
lanterns.
that.
Yeah, a
They
lot of
were
great points. I
looking
mean,
for
I
the wife, and
definitely,
all of a
once you
sudden you
brought
see
up
the
the wedding
husband's
band, I
face come
do
very close
remember
to the
seeing,
camera,
it
calling right to the
specifically
camera
on
for the
him
wife.
several times within this film.
And the
And
last
you're
thing
right, I didn't
was,
really
I just
pay attention
noticed
to
the
her, but you
wedding
knew
ring.
it
They
was on
really made
him.
sure you saw that on his hand. I didn't really catch it if it was on, if you saw it on hers, but on his, you almost saw it all the
Yeah.
time.
Yeah, back to your point a little
And
bit
that's it for me.
about the film aspect ratio. There are two surviving Masterprints. One is Cali, one of the LA school. I can't remember which one, but UCLA or USC.
Right.
One is one of the other. I can't remember now. But they had a print there, and then there's
Right.
another print from Czech Republican. So
Put they were pushing the
the one
point.
that's from here is the one that has is the left side or something a little lopped off because of the. They had the soundtrack because this is similar to City Lights in the 1930 something with Chaplin, where
Oh, wow.
it's a silent film, but if you play it, it actually has a soundtrack laid out because it contains the score,
Yeah.
some minimal sound effects. And I think this particular film had the same exact thing. So what we're listening to today
31.
is a
Yeah.
restored kind of reconstructed
Yep.
version of that, whatever they have. I couldn't quite find out if it was exactly from there, but it's something that was meant to go along with the film by the time they released this. Because it's right at that time frame where the jazz singer is arriving and things were being changed in terms of sound technology. But in Europe, it was totally silent, and that's why in Europe, the check print had the complete aspect ratio because they didn't have to deal with the soundtrack at all. So most of the restoration probably came from the check print so that you could see all the missing left columns, but at least something like 5 to 10% of the picture or so of the frame. So that's the restoration piece. Going back to SAR are also the sort of, I guess I think both of you made a little bit a point about this, but the interesting thing I thought of was the sort of the duality, the dual nature of what he was trying to examine kind of comes in play across almost every single element of the movie itself, right? So it's the Song of Two Humans, so it's got two people, and like you were saying, the city woman is more of a, it's similar to, remember The Wind? We talked about how one of the male characters in there is almost like the wind, right? He's the personification of a natural force, right, at work, which of course that director is the guy that originally inspired F.W. Murnau's obsession with nature, being an element of his movies, right? In even his earlier movies, Murnau's movies, we've seen how nature, what's that guy with the, I forgot what the title is, but the Dog Hunt movie where it's all raining all the time, constantly, the storm outside.
Yeah, the castle.
Yeah, the Haunted Castle, that's what it
Haunted
was.
Castle.
Yeah, so,
Oh, by the way, I've seen that term used again, so maybe they did call mansions castles back then. Okay.
So,
That was always bugging me.
yeah, so that's kind of a common thing that he basically was inspired by A Man There Was, that of course, the Swedish director made. Anyways, back to this film is that this woman, like those films, the character herself kind of represents that element of force, but also that there's a difference between man and woman, and that's exactly personified of different desires, needs, and human sexuality and stuff like that. And so I think it's a part of what he's trying to express. Also, it's based on the short story, right? Excursion to Tilsit by Herman Suderman, way earlier. But the concept I think is brilliant because it's not just man and woman, but also like city versus rural, light versus dark, the sun versus the moon. You've got many, many expositions and many, many shots of the moon when it comes to women, and the sun comes to the man, or vice versa. Like there's this contrast of man and woman, and sun and the moon, the day and the night, the light and the dark, the city and the rural. The water and dry land. It's just amazing how, it seems to be a simple picture, but beneath the surface, there's all this incredible rich symbols of what all of those elements play up to be. Right, and if you remember the commentary, because I think we listened to the same commentary by Bailey. Would he highlights how there's even like throwaway pieces of the Maya characters where you've got men and women, strangers who sit next to each other, and kind of how they relate to each other, throughout the picture, right? Even from the start of when he's getting a haircut or something. And the wife is sitting next to the man, and how, there's complexities there. Or later on when they're back, one of the guy who found her, rescued her from drowning, the wife, was sitting next to, I think, the nanny, right? Or maid or whatever. And they have their own sort of,
Spat.
yeah, their own piece until his wife was like, what's going on here in the background, So there are all these interplays of like many different motifs weaving in and out. So that's a incredibly rich backdrop of this film, which, if having seen several Murnau movies by now. It's a common thing. He's been doing it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, throughout all his films, there are all these dualities and this contrasting nature of, this and that, right? There's always these dual natures at play and forces at underneath the surface fighting with one another, right? So, if anything, he's just kind of bringing that back to the forefront, but also that he's doing it with a big Hollywood budget now that he's in Hollywood and he's.
Yeah. I like the comedic scenes with the strap coming down all the time and the other guy kept fixing it.
Yeah, that was the other scene too, yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally he was just like, ah, the heck with
She slaps him. Yeah. The article
it.
said something about that, how it turned into, it went from comedy to violence. She slapped him. But I think
Yes.
he overstated that a little bit. It was just funny.
But that's the thing is that it is it's got all these themes throughout the whole film of like all of those contrasting points, right?
Right.
But above and beyond that, I think he's also bringing a lot of not as big as the Caligari, the expressionism, but like if you look at all of the set buildings, right, and all the aesthetics, they're all very much callbacks to.
Well, all the rooms had these floors that were, none of them were flat. There were a lot of them were at an angle coming from the door.
Yes, on purpose, right?
Yeah,
This is the
right.
call because even the film itself, again, it's, I think from some of the commentaries and materials, none of them had actual names. All these characters
Right.
had like the man, the wife, woman from the city, the maid, the
Yeah.
photographer, the barber,
Harold Lloyd did that.
obtrusive.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So it very much is
Just a
it's almost like a
parable.
fable, right? There, it's not trying to be realistic. It's trying to be say, it's trying to make a point about
Right.
what it is about these. It's the whole concept of like women from Venus and men from Mars. They're also different. How can they all relate to one another? And
We
also,
you can tell it wasn't supposed to be taken seriously that when he first ran out of the house to go to the vamp and she was just ready to serve soup, she was dejected. And I couldn't tell if the two women talking about her were in the house with her or if they were outside or what that deal was. So it just felt very fluid. It just you weren't supposed to take it too seriously as far
Right.
as space and who's invading which space.
Right.
Or even for that scene too, it's like did she, I mean I you have the feeling that she knows this has been going on for a while, but
Oh, yeah.
it's never really addressed, and I feel like not that the ball was dropped there, but I don't know, it was just kind of you think she'd be more mad in that respect of her, losing her husband to this vampy lady. And then, then he tries to kill her, and then she's all upset. And I was just kind of like, I just felt like for Janna Gaynor's character's emotions, they were too far flung and
Right. She
not,
was too much the
yeah.
martyr at the beginning.
Yeah, very much the martyr, which also not a bad theme to follow, but you kind of have to slide into those emotions. You just can't go from one extreme to the
Yeah.
other unless you're bipolar.
Well, she might have been.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't come across that way in the
No,
movies,
no.
so.
Yeah. If anything, the vamp was.
Right. But I think the point wasn't so much to realistic human relationships. I think the point
Yeah.
was more of like a fable or
A medieval fable, yeah.
yeah, it's more mythic than just based on real life. And I think that's why there's so much of like all those elements I mentioned, right? And so there's less of realism, but more just what all these characters represent behind them, the ideas that they have, I was wondering. The woman from the city, this is my own conjecture. I'm not sure I found this in any other, not that I did extensive research, but the things that I read about. But it seems to me like her job, I mean, it says she's vacationing, but I also felt like the woman from the city had an ulterior motive of convincing people in the rural area and the farmland to sell their
Oh, right, yeah,
materials to get
maybe.
rid of the farm thing. And to me, almost like I might be reading too much into this, but it feels almost like industrialization a little bit of like
Maybe.
because that was the the time period. It's actually post-industrial age, just, you know, a little bit, you know, it's like people are moving on beyond that now. But it's like, you know, you're in the farm, agrarian society, get rid of that and, you know, sell your stuff. Like he had to sell his, they didn't really get into the reason why the man had to
Yeah.
sell his cows or some stuff like that.
Usually films are, when they introduce something, they pay it off, but that never paid off.
Exactly. So I'm wondering if
It just
she
slipped
was the
in.
one, the woman in the city, who convinced the man to sell the cow, and that got
Oh,
the whole
maybe.
family into a deep rut. And either she's taking money for herself, or she's working on behalf of a large corporation. I don't know. This is all
No, I
extra
totally
stuff
get
I'm
it.
leaving into it. But it's just so interesting that she represents that sort of element of instability, right? Of wreaking havoc on not just this man and woman. I think in that rural town, I think it's just like, that's why people are like whispering when she's around or doesn't, you know, take to her kindly, because she's, again, is representative of, you know, what everything that is from the city, you know, the fears from the city is, you know.
I love the set design of where she was staying, and she goes into the room where I'm guessing the landlords were
Right.
eating their meal. It was set up like this crazy cartoon, very German expressionism, because their table was like tilted up to the left, our left. She's coming down this very steep incline. Everything just, it was like shoved together, almost like a cartoon. Just something. It was like very Caligari-ish.
Oh, sure. I mean, obviously he would have known that. He would continue to espouse all the things that he learned from Max Reinhardt, you know. So because Max was the guy who inspired, you know, Robert Wien and everybody who's doing expressionism, you know, that's kind of the, they all kind of came up together or would have known each other, you know what I mean? And so incredibly inspired by all those things for sure.
I just love the visuals.
Oh yeah, I mean, all of the visuals again, is, I think I've said it to the death, but After Being Murdered's visuals from a technical perspective is just second to none. This is why.
Well, look at the church. The commentary said that that sun ray was painted there.
Well, maybe he says
It was
he's
hard to know.
doubting that. He's doubting that because
Oh, really?
yeah, it was like the people, you know, there's claims that there's, you know, you paint the light into the wall, which sounds like something that Expressionism would have done, but I think Expressionism painted shadows, I think, more than lights, you know. And so, like, he thinks that it's just, you know, real lights. And but the fact
It's
that,
hard
you
to
know,
know, yeah.
through that entire scene, the couple would move from the dark into the light and then, you know, back out again. And it's just the whole rich symbol of like their own rededication, you know,
Yeah.
of their own marriage. And when they come out of the church, and there, it's now taking place in the community, right? And right, it all adds to the point that it's not so much that they're actually representing real sort of, you know,
But you always
character
want to know how they
figures.
do certain things. I
It's
know
more just,
Ebert was stumped for a longest time about the camera through the swamp, and then finally someone told him.
right. It's more just about the fact that they represent concepts behind them, you know, so. And how, of course, they had to go from the rural to the city to find themselves, the farthest point away from, you know, where they are basing based their where their life is based, you know.
But the whole thing, yeah, that was a great film.
Just laughing over here. I'm like, yep, I do have to agree, even though I don't fully agree with what happened in the movie. But
Yeah, it's
it's
not
worth a
supposed to play
watch.
out like a natural story of a real person in a real relationship. I think it's all tied together in the fact that it's almost like a mythology. It's like a fake, you know, a fable or
But I almost feel
fairy
it's
tale, you
yeah,
know.
it I feel that way too, but it's in the sense that this was made in the 20s. I almost feel like it is a movie of its time. Like that's my that's when my grandparents were born in the 20s, but I almost feel like you think of that time period in civilization and it's kind of like a gentler time where compared to now we're all like fierce and kind of oppressive. Yeah. I don't know. It just, in that respect, you know, you see this movie and you're kind of like, it's very gentle with like the love part of the marriage. So.
Well, even they were out of place because they were showing how busy and sophisticated life was within the city, mm-hmm. and they were kind of out of place there, but they liked looking at them because I think they like to feel, okay, this is a gentler time right in front of us when they start doing the peasant dance, you know, the summertime peasant dance.
Yeah, that was kind of funny.
Yeah. I loved the hair salon. It was it looked like the early 30s because Art Deco seemed to be creeping in, and it was just so grand. You know, it was just so big.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can go on. There's just to me, there's a lot to talk about with Sunrise because of the sort of heritage of Murnau and how he was recruited by William Fox to do this really artistic picture. And I think William Fox probably was thinking he got more than he bargained for. He was just thinking it's going to be a good picture. He was like, whoa, what is this thing? You know, that came out of this, you know, I'm not sure they even know how to sell it after it was made, you know, so, but we can, I think, wrap it up for now because we do have to talk about one more short after this.
Sure.
So any parting thoughts about this before we move on?
I'm good.
Just for me being like, you know, the youngest of the group, going from Nosferatu to seeing this film from Murnau and not knowing any of his other films in between. I like how, you know, I love how directors can branch out into different formats and themes and still, you know, hold that title of, you know, his name, you know, that weight is there just saying like, this is, you know, I own this movie. This is my film, you know, go see it. I hope you like it. And I don't know. It just kind of, like I said, I expected more of a horror because of Nosferatu, and I'm glad this wasn't. And even though it tied into the themes of like, you know, the horror and thriller genre and whatnot, I was pleasantly surprised by what I watched. So, good movie.
I'm curious about his next one called Taboo. I'm going to check it out. I think.
That's his final movie. It's a documentary.
Oh, I didn't realize. Okay, it's silent though, isn't it? Or is it?
Yeah, sort of. It's like this picture. The soundtrack is laid out, so it's gonna be synchronized to the film. It's just
I think it's Criterion, so I'm gonna check it out.
It's co-directed with Robert Flaherty. Now, if you don't know anything about Robert Flaherty, you do.
Nanook.
Yeah, so he's one of the first, if not, or early pioneers. I don't want to use first a lot, but early pioneers of documentaries in general. And he
he'd fake them, but yeah.
But that's kind of the point is. Which documentary today doesn't really fake him anyways?
Well, that's true.
It's a very interesting insight. It's a really interesting insight, even in the beginning of film, on what is a documentary. Is it something that is shaped by the storyteller, or is it actually something totally objective? And the reality is you can't be 100% totally objective when you're cutting and editing together something to present to people. You have to take a point of view, even if you feel like you're not taking a point of view. You know what I mean?
Actually, what really got me started on this trip I've been on for a while now was someone gave me a book just as I was leaving a job called 1001 Movies to Watch. And that's where I found Nanook, and that's where I found many others.
Somebody gave me that for a birthday present. That's funny.
Yeah, I still have it. Yeah. And I've been seeing, because of Criterion, I've been seeing most of them now.
Yeah. I think I've seen most of the...
But that's how I saw Nanook. Like, how'd they get that camera in the igloo? And sure enough, that was faked.
Well, that's the thing, you know? So anyway, that's a whole nother.
Huge. Yeah.
That's a whole nother topic unto itself. But with regard to Murnau, he did a variety of, I feel like, types of movies. I mean, he did, what was the thing we saw first?
Journey into the Night.
Haunted Castle, which we saw. And then he did The Burning Soil. And then after that, Nosferatu, and then Phantom, and then he did the Finances of Grand Duke, The Last Laugh, Tartuffe, Faust,
The Last Laugh,
and after that he came to do Sunrise, and then after that he did Four Devils, It's generally regarded to be his best work, which is lost.
Which one?
Unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
Four Devils. Now, if you have the DVD still, or the Blu-ray, you could actually watch, quote-unquote, watch the Four Devils using a construction of still photography. It's quite interesting.
Hmm.
So check it out if you have time. It's on one of the disc menu somewhere. It's just called The Four Devils Reconstructed or something like that.
Yeah, the DVD, not Blu-ray. So, yeah, we'll see.
Should be the same. But anyways, that was quite interesting. And then he did one more called City Girl, 1930, before he did the Taboo. And I would say almost all of those tackle different genres and different types of topics. So
that's an artist, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, he died really young, you know.
Yeah.
With
car accident.
Yeah, car accident. So anyway, that's that. We're going to move on to, I totally forgot to mention, but we're going to tackle the Lauren Hardy's The Battle of the Century. You guys managed. Oh, and before we get there, I just thought of something I should just mention about the Sunrise thing, because it just came to me. I should have mentioned it earlier, but I totally forgot until now. A lot of it was the way the movement of the man did was like, you mentioned Frankenstein, but as I was thinking more of the Golem.
Oh, okay.
The 1915 film with Paul Wagoner.
Yeah, I think I saw the one after the 15 was the first one? I must have seen the second one, the polished one.
Yeah.
He did it twice, yeah.
And anyway, so that's kind of the whole concept. It's a takeoff of that character, which is obviously kind of inspired Frankenstein as well.
Probably.
So, anyways.
Well, the outfit he was wearing, it looked like Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And plus he's a bodybuilder, so he had, you know, everything came together.
All right, so let's move on to Battle of the Century. What do you think of this little short ditty, Lauren Hardy?
I've never seen a Laurel and Hardy picture, so I really liked it. And we'll have this in the show notes, too. The video you sent us, too, was also extremely interesting about how a lot of the film was missing for a very, very long time. It's probably like 95% complete now, but knowing that at one point it was thought to be a completely missing film is, you know, it's funny, you know, you see these films and you can't imagine that they're all gone, but you know, the reality is they are, because I don't know, maybe some kids lit them on fire in the middle of a burning lake.
I saw that.
You know, so basically I was talking about for the next scene, the pie throwing scene was one of my favorites in this film because of how absurd and ridiculous it was. I really like the pacing and timing of how it was completed, though, because it does stretch for a long amount of, you know, watch time. And you think, oh, okay, this is kind of a little over the top and a little ridiculous, but it flows really well. And, you know, it just kind of keeps going. You know, you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 10, 20, 40, 60 people eventually all throwing pies at each other. And even though it's just like, it's the same gag repeated, because the way it was styled and, you know, all these different people from walks of life, the ridiculousness of it made it just that much more enjoyable. Like, I never felt annoyed watching the pie fight at all. I just thought it was genuinely funny. You know, it's like, how many times do you ever get a pie thrown in at your face in your life? Never. So now you get to see 200 people get a pie in their face. But yeah, I don't remember what else I said after that. Battle of the Century, good film. For someone who doesn't know much about Stan and Ollie, I'm going to watch more of their stuff. I know we mentioned more of their stuff is popular for the talkies. I think that's part of the original podcast, though. So I'm going to stop, and Adam, you can take back over again.
Thanks, Lily. I've always been aware of Laurel and Hardy, but I've never really followed them. And I know a lot of people have imitated them. Watching Gilligan's Island, you're basically watching them. Mm-hmm. Growing up during the 60s, watching the 60s, I grew up in the 70s. I was watching Dick Van Dyke all the time, and he used to imitate Stanley Laurel. And they were also friends together. So when he did a whole bit that was basically one of his routines, he asked for feedback, and Stanley basically gave this long list of things he did wrong. So he took it like a trooper, and, you know, he understood, and his friendship meant more than getting mad, and he actually gave the eulogy at Stanley's funeral, so that shows you how close they were. I've been watching the festival as far as silent films go, from Italy, and they had a lot of features of Oliver and Hardy separately. I mean, Laurel and Hardy separately. You'd see Stanley's things, and you'd see Ollie's things. So to see them in silent film together, that was something different. The one thing that really struck me, it was nice to see the documentary beforehand about how they found the second rail. But watching it, I'm thinking to myself, was that supposed to be even the same film? I mean, I saw nothing that tied reel one with reel two at all. They were in different situations doing different things. I've noticed a lot of silent films seem, or even the Three Stooges for that part, seem to like doing boxing gags, especially I think it was City, was it City Lights, or one of the films by Charlie Chaplin that it was even one of his favorite scenes, because it takes a long time to set something like that up where it works out well. Pie scene on the second rail. I'm not usually a fan of pie fights because to me, I just never got it. But the way they did it was actually funny. And it was long. It was the longest pie fight I've ever seen. But their timing, I've been watching a lot of silent films, even comedy ones, where everything seems sped up either through undercranking or just through their timing. So what I saw, and I know Stanley was the biggest writer of the two, and I'm sure he set them up. Everything from the banana scene that led up to the pie scene, everything just took its time. You know, it was very deliberate. It wasn't. It just wasn't sped up. It was just well done. The mayor showing up out of nowhere, dressed up the way he was something straight out of a Monopoly game. You know, it's just, it was like an archetype of what a mayor should look like, which I'm sure they had that in mind. I think my favorite part of the scenes was, I think toward the end, where the pie hit the floor and not someone directly, and the woman was walking by and she slipped on it, and just the look she had on her face, it was so natural. It didn't look like something that was forced, something that was scripted. It just looked like she might have actually. I mean, I know she didn't do it. I know the whole thing was staged. You could kind of tell, but at the same time, it looked very natural, and she looked truly embarrassed about the whole thing. So yeah, I can see why this was a lot of people's favorites. It was nice to see the second reel, because the first reel was nice, but the second, just it was almost like an extra. And that's it.
Yeah, it was City Lights, by the way, the boxing scene, which was they brought it back from when he was doing shorts. He'd been doing that too, which everybody and their grandma, if you're in the silence and you're doing comedy, has done, I'm sure, something about boxing, you know. But the thing about the multiple storyline, that's pretty common, I think, for a lot of silent shorts, is that they don't always have to do one another. They usually have various scenes, and you transition from one scene to the next to the next to the next. So typically half a reel to one reel is one scene before they go to the next reel. And so even a two or three reeler comedy routine would be usually two or three different stories loosely tied together.
I just didn't see any tie.
Oh yeah, because I think the some of the transitions were part of the Lost era, I think. But anyways, the banana thing I thought was interesting, because I don't remember which one now, but we did see a Buster Keaton one
Battling Bubba.
where I can't remember the details. He was getting chased, and there's a banana peel on the ground. And of course, you know, most comedians are slipping on the banana peel, but the joke is that you never do, right? That's the thing of Buster Keaton. And so with this one, they did do that for the first however long it went on for. It was just like, you know, Lauren Hardy, they were like, let's do it, and then never did get done. You know what I mean? So that was the gag. But the pie thing was tremendous, because I think, you know, like the behind the scenes thing, I linked it. There were, you know, everybody's done the pie thing for a long time, but it really is the, or maybe it was the, no, I probably heard this on an interview with the one of the archivists. Trying to restore the recently there's a thing called the a definitive collection. What's it called? The different restorations. Lauren
Not the
Hardy.
Criterion.
No.
TCM. Yeah.
Oh, is it them? You talking about
it's
Lauren
released,
Hardy?
Yeah, yeah. It's a release this year in June 2016. It's a compilation. Remastered Lauren Hardy films released by TCM. I think either UCL or USC did the remaster on them. But the point is, this is part of it. This particular short, but the point is it also that it's more that when they proposed this idea, the pie fights had been done to the death. Like nobody wants to do another one. I think their proposal was to see what if we did the granddaddy of it all, so that it would be the pie fight to end all pie fights. And so the quote they were quoted saying this may have taken more than 3,000 green pies or maybe 10,000. Who knows? Like, but that's supposedly in the Guinness Book.
It's funny that the Three Stooges continued that considering it was already done to death.
Well, you know, comedy's comedy. But the point is, at that point in time, it's spectacular, right? Because you've seen pie fights before, at least even in the silent film era, but not to the degree where it's one thing after another. It just keeps escalating, right? So
fun.
But yeah, that also is my favorite part. It just... it's also not something that you kind of have to know the context to be funny. I think this is one of the things that you can just drop any modern audiences in, and without any context, they will find it funny. The pie fight part. Mm. You know what I mean?
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to show this to my kids. I'm sure they'll...
Oh, they're going to love it. Oh,
well, because it's one of those that like, you don't really... Again, you shouldn't... Yeah. The best ones are the ones that you really don't need to understand. Right. For the context, and you kind of get it, you know. So, but there have been silent films where it might be funny because I know a lot about the context, and that's what makes it funny. But if you drop today's modern audience in straight, they might find bits and pieces of it funny, but it's really not as funny as it could have been, right? So,
yeah.
But this is definitely one of those where.
Well, like I said, it was relaxed. It took its time. It didn't speed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely a classic in that regard. Yeah. So, highly recommend it. It's on YouTube for now. It's also part of the Definitive Restorations by TCM, released earlier. I don't know if it's a limited edition, but if you're able to, you can buy the whole set. I think most of it is talkies, but they did find this amongst a few other shorts in the silent era. And I also like you guys haven't seen a lot of their material, I think, but they have been in, according to this, 34 silent shorts, 45 sound shorts, 27 full length sound features. And so they have had a career and a half, both independently as well as together, you know. That's what we got in that.
Okay.
All right.
Very cool.
That wraps up that short, Lauren Hardy's Battle of the Century. And that was, let's see what year that was. That was 1927.
Oh, same year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if that was the short before that movie.
Who knows? Maybe. All right. That's pretty much all we have for tonight. So thank you, listeners. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Lily. And next week, I believe it'll be the last one for Adam, I think.
Right.
You can find more of our stuff at watchingsilentfilms.wordpress.com. Again, that's watchingsilentfilms.wordpress.com. Send an email if you have any thoughts, comments, ideas. watchingsilentfilms.wordpress@gmail.com. And please leave a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you find our podcast from, and go from there. So thanks again, everyone. Have a good evening.
Bye.
Ciao.